This week on Writers, Inc.
My book, Write for Money and Power, talks about the benefits of having a paid newsletter, self-publishing, and having freelancing, because those three pillars are really the thing that can make you indestructible as a writer.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I am going through every writer's worst nightmare today. My Mac is dying.
No.
So we were on vacation last week up in the mountains. We'll talk about that in a second. But like it started to just kind of crap out. Like I was just working and it just rebooted itself. So I took like, you know, Macs have this little box that comes up that says your Mac shut down unexpectedly. You want to report it. If you click on the report button, it gives you this giant long thing of garbled nonsense. I took the garbled nonsense and I dropped it into Claude and said, what does this mean? And Claude said, you need to buy a new Mac now, !
Oh, no.
and then it went into all the things that are going wrong with my Mac. And like, it made me really sad because I've got a MacBook Pro, but it's got that touch screen up at the top, which they don't make anymore.
Don't do that,
and I really love that touch screen. So I've held on to it, but it's like it's a 2019 model, you know, which is, I guess, a dinosaur in computer language or computer age.
Well,
but so it's got to go.
I have one. I was thinking of selling if you're desperately wanting
a 2019.
I pulled the trigger right before we got on the podcast. I dropped it to the Apple store and spent like $2,000 on a new one that should be here, I guess, in about a week or so. But I'm hoping that it's going to last that long because I got another message just before saying that the battery's not charging.
Yikes.
Yeah, that's no good.
Yeah. It's not
what's
good
at what's all. Interesting to me about that is that this past week, I decided to start writing something by hand. So I've been writing every other day, really. Because what I do is I write it, and then I take a photo of it, and I have ChatGPT translate it into text. I edit that, and then I write the next scene by hand. So,
or you could just type it into Scrivener and save
really
about 2 hours out of your...
No. It's really interesting what the impact that this is having on... It slowed me down, and so I'm doing... some interesting things with the scenes. I don't know. I'll give a full report later, but it's interesting. I like it as a process. I mean, it's fun.
Say that when you handwrite things, you like handwriting notes is really good because you repeat it in your brain like 5 times or something. Whereas when you type, it doesn't. So you actually retain more. So yeah. I do think there could be something to writing a story by hand, although that does seem
yeah,
like
I
a
mean,
lot.
It does slow you down. I did it when I was doing a fantasy because I wanted a slower pace, which it was cool. And, you know, fun fact, cursive actually is a different network in your brain than typing or printing. So, you know.
Isn't cursive gone? Didn't they do away with cursive?
Oh, yeah. My son can't read my cursive. So if I want, like, to say something about him to my husband, I just write it in cursive. And he's like, what's that say? Can't even read it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like secret code.
Did I ever tell you how I got called into the principal's office when my son was in like second grade because he taught himself how to write cursive because they wouldn't teach him. And then he refused to write in print. And the teacher was like, he can't do that. And I'm like,
why not?
You know what's funny about that? I got called in the principal's office in like 7th or 8th grade because I refused to write in cursive and would only print. So my half times have changed. That's kind of infuriating.
Yeah, I had to go take time off of work and go meet with the teacher and just be like, can you read cursive? Like, I don't understand what the problem is. And they literally said, we don't want the other kids to feel bad. And that's not something we teach until next year. And I was like, well, like... That sounds like a you problem, not a me
So they're
problem.
punishing him for being too advanced.
Too advanced,
That's what they're
basically.
doing. That is no way to get me to help you with anything. You tell me
Right.
my kid has to be held back because it'll make other kids feel bad.
Yeah.
Boo frickin' who?
It was an interesting experience, I'll say that.
You have enraged me with this story. I want to find these people now.
Yeah, I used to get sent to the office because of attention issues. So I just wouldn't notice the bell would ring and I wouldn't come in at recess. Anyway, that was a me problem.
Well, I appreciate you guys covering last week. I tried really hard to get on, but like we were at this mountain resort skiing, and I use that term lightly because I am not a ski. Well, I guess like I'm sort of a skier now. Did you guys ski at all? Any of you?
I have skied.
Badly.
I haven't done it in a long time.
Oh, so my daughter, growing up north and growing up here, like she's learned to ski pretty early. I think 3 years old, they had her on skis, and now she's 8. So like she's a pro. She just goes up and down the mountain without any problem. My wife picked it up a couple of years ago, and she's been trying to keep up with my daughter, so she's been doing well. I've never tried it because I think we've talked about this before, but I had a bad motorcycle wreck back in the 90s, and I completely trashed my right leg, and I can't feel anything from the knee down. So skiing just seemed like something I should not do. But like we're at the ski resort, I'm standing at the bottom of the mountain. I'm watching my wife and daughter go up the hill, ski down the hill. They're having so much fun, and like I can only stand there so long and like not do it, because like I had like this moment in my head. I'm like, do I want to spend the next 30 years watching them do this because we're going to continue to go to ski vacations, or do I want to actually try? So I decided I was going to try. So I went and rented all the gear, came back out. My daughter's like, I'll teach you. Now keep in mind she's 8, so she brought me to this little hill. She's like, okay, this is called pizza. And you basically put your skis in like a triangle. This is called French fries. This
French
is
fries.
you do pizza to stop. You do French fries if you want to move fast. And that was like the end of her lesson. I'm like, well, how do I turn? And she said, oh, you just lean. You'll figure it out. It's easy. So let's go. And like then she gets me on the lift, and like and I'm just following her, which is kind of stupid. But I get on the lift, quick, all the way to the top of this mountain. And granted, it's like the easiest hill on the mountain, but it is still a mountain. So we get off the lift, and I stand up, I get on my skis, I start skiing, and I'm like, oh, this isn't so bad. And like I'm going and going and getting faster and faster and faster, and like I whip past my daughter, and she's like, "Daddy, you got to slow down, pizza, pizza!" Yeah, like she's screaming at me, and then she's like, way in my rear view. I can't even hear her anymore. So finally, I put my butt down and kind of like sat on the snow, and like I did that 3 times to get to the bottom of the mountain, and figured like this was a bad idea. So then I signed up for actual adult lessons, and had somebody teach me. I spent 2 hours with some guy, and that actually worked. Like he gave me the basics. I was able to go back up on the mountain after that, get down without falling, and repeat it a bunch of times. The weather was kind of fighting us. It was like -5, I think, one day when we were out there. So like it was
Yikes.
cold. But yeah, so I'm officially a very bad skier.
Congratulations.
I am also a bad skier, if it helps. Yeah, I wonder, like, that's got to be weird skiing with no feeling in one leg. I
Well,
can't
it's yeah.
imagine
I mean, it's one of those
that.
things I've been dealing with forever. Like, I'm just used to it not being there.
Yeah.
So, like, I had the poles, the ski poles, and like I almost used it like a crutch. Like, they don't really do anything, but like just being able to hold on to that pole kind of helped me keep my balance.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, my wife said that I should probably try snowboarding, that it
That's
might
what I
actually be
was
easier.
thinking. You have to be like a reverse snowboarder, though. Go down with your
But you
left
can't
leg, right?
pizza when you're on a snowboard. So.
Yeah,
You
I don't
can't
know. Like,
pizza
I
on a
saw.
snowboard.
We went to another mountain for lunch. We like took this gondola up, and it was like a 6-minute gondola ride. It was way up there, and like people were skiing from there. And like I'm watching these little kids on snowboards. They can't be more than like 4 or 5 years old, and they're like literally going over the side of a cliff and then just vanishing, and then coming. Like they show up again another 40 minutes later. So snowboarding looks way more scary, I
I
think they
tried it
say.
once. I was very sore afterwards. That was the end of my
Snowboarding.
snowboarding.
Not that I ski and or snowboard, but everyone in my family does both, so I'm familiar with like the concepts. But I've always heard that snowboarding, I don't know that it's easier, because like you don't have control of your feet, right? Like they're both like locked into a board, and so like it's definitely like, I guess easier in some ways, but harder in other ways. So I don't know. Skiing, it always felt like if I were going to try one, I would definitely try skiing versus snowboarding based on knowing people who do both.
Yeah.
I went into it, you know, like I've water skied my whole life because I grew up in Florida. So I went into it knowing I can water ski. That they're totally different. Like one has nothing to do with the other, yeah. other than that they look similar. So like I falsely convinced myself that I knew what I was doing.
I had an experience where I was an ice skater for a lot of years and I was pretty good, that I was going to play recreational hockey and just sign up for a league. And I'd never had hockey skates on before. And I was like, oh, I better try one public skate. I was black and blue, like, but they're not the same. I cannot skate in the hockey skates. I did play two seasons of Hellsing, but it was not great.
They don't have the things on the front.
They don't
right?
have toe picks. Yeah, and they're a very different blade. They're like rounded, and it's just not the same at all.
I went ice skating like one time in my life and did okay with it, but for some reason it really hurt like the arches of my feet, and that's why I've never done it again. Yeah. Like I kept my balance. I did fine. I even did some little turns and things and got kind of fancy with it like I would on roller skates. But then my feet were in excruciating pain.
You know, it's kind of interesting. I can't ice skate as well as you probably, Christine, but it came easier to me when I did try it. But I think when I tried it and I was younger, because I had done like, I don't know, 10, 12 years of ballet, and you don't really notice like how many muscles like actually exist in your feet and your ankles and things.
Or don't
exist. Yeah. But I think that, cause I know even with roller skating, like all that stuff, like came really easy to me as a kid. And as an adult, I've looked back and often thought, oh, I bet it was like the ballet and the dancing, because you just get all of those tiny little muscles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you think you can do things and you get good. I don't recommend taking rollerblades off of a skateboard jump. That's how I broke my leg. But we can talk about that another time.
All right, let's save it. Yeah, Kevin, what is in the news?
All right, well, first up, Audible tests in-app promo videos, because when I think audiobooks, I think video. In December, Audible began testing in-app vertical videos for book promotion. Self-publishers can add trailers, author interviews, and more to drive audiobook discovery. The feature is now in beta, available to about half of Audible users.
This sounds horrible.
It does sound horrible.
I let the video
It sounds like they're trying to cash in on the book talk thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I let the video link in. It was, I think it's to the Harlan Coben Reese Witherspoon book. And it was, you know, very professional, well done, kind of neat. I guess if you're scrolling to see what you want to listen to next.
Yeah.
Well, the reason it's freaking me out, like, do you guys use Apple News at all? Like I read Apple News like once a day or so, but they just changed their video format. So if there's a news ad or like a video ad somewhere in the story you're reading, you can't just scroll over it anymore. As soon as you scroll over it, it automatically goes to full size and just starts playing.
Oh, automatic out for me.
That's annoying.
Yeah, you can't stop it. You got to like fly past it. And like, it seems like you have to do it like three times before it'll actually let you bypass it. And like that kind of stuff just annoys the hell out of me. Makes me not want to use the app at all. And frankly, if Audible goes in that direction, then I will find another source for my audiobooks.
Surely it's not. I mean, because I don't look at my screen at all when I'm, you know, when I've got an audiobook going or when I'm.
So I think it's probably more for selection. It's more like a book trailer. Like, hey, this book is out.
I'm annoyed enough that Audible at the end of a book now does this thing where it's like, here's another book that we think you'll like, and we're going to play the first chapter. And I'm like, I don't want to start a book that I don't own. So this is a no. You know,
that's one of those things that it makes sense on paper. Like I can see the marketing meeting where somebody, you know, like a light bulb went off and they thought this would be a good idea, but it's intrusive. Nobody really likes it. And even if you're into that book that you're listening to, you know, you get to the end of that sample, then you have to go out and buy the book. And for whatever reason, they can't seem to sync the two up. So you've got to go back and try to find your spot again. Yeah. You got to fast forward and say, okay, I think I heard through this point. Oh, no, that's too far. I got to go back. It's a pain in the ass. Like leave stuff as a basic, you know, platform. That's it. Leave all this garbage off.
That's one thing that Kindle has right, though, is that when you read a sample, they'll sync up when you buy it. So they got that.
Yeah, but I was just saying, I gave up on the whole WhisperSync thing. Because what was happening was I'd read the book for a while in the Kindle. I'd listen to it while driving or something, read a little more in the Kindle. When I went back to listen, it would like jump back. And I sort of caught myself listening to the same chapter like four times in a row. Without realizing it. And so I gave up on that whole thing.
Okay, here's self-imposed. I got a sleep headband and it's got like speakers in it and you can put it over your eyes and then I fall asleep and it just keeps going. So then I don't remember. The book is done when I wake up and I'm like, where was I? So I do that to myself. That's fine.
Now, for me, it's pizza. Pizza. Stop. Stop the whole
Yeah.
thing. All right. Next up, watch for these 2026 social media trends. Social platforms will prioritize on-platform commerce and search over links and hashtags. Integrated e-commerce, such as TikTok Shop, pay-to-post models, and social native search mean creators must optimize for keywords, alt text, and in-platform conversions rather than driving traffic off-site. Algorithms shift toward personalization, depth, and time on post with fewer hashtags. Long form video on TikTok and YouTube is expanding the fight scroll fatigue, while digital avatars, metaverse style projects, and AI heavy hustle content are losing audience trust and traction. You know, I understood every word of this, just not the order it was in.
Well, it's interesting. I saw Instagram just went to a maximum of five hashtags, and I believe TikTok did it as well. And they want longer videos now, more engagement versus like the quick sell, which is, I don't know if there's a trend shift coming or what is going on with that. You're shaking your
Well,
head, Jen,
yeah,
saying
because
no.
the hashtags did get out of control for a while. Like you had to, they were very long.
Hashtag out of control.
They were very out of control. But I don't even think that they really work.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's using them.
Are the algorithms still using hashtags? Because I was told
I
that they're
don't think
not, that they just
so.
ignore them
I was
now.
told
I
that
don't
too.
know. I mean, I think you like people search the hashtags, but I don't know that they're going into the
I've never met
algorithm.
anyone who does that. So,
I search Book Talk. That's like the only one I ever search. Like Book Talk or Bookstagram, I will search, yeah, to see what's
I
going
have
on.
searched it before, but that was like years ago, when like you could like search the hashtag and it would like bring up, like a contest or something. But I don't know. Last time I tried, it was like really random. Like you type in the hashtag to do the search function on Instagram, and it was weird. I'm not convinced it works.
Yeah, so I don't know, keywords, alt text. Apparently they said in this article also LinkedIn is dying. Nobody wants to be there. So just a reminder, don't be on one social media platform, make your own audience, you know.
LinkedIn is like an event horizon. It sucks so bad. It
Yeah.
is such a horrible experience. I don't
Well,
want to be on
I never
LinkedIn.
understood why they tried to make it like a social media thing anyway. It was always meant to be like your
Because
resume.
that's what all the popular kids were doing,
Resume,
Jenna.
yeah.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Everybody's trying to do all the things. You know, they're all
Yeah.
trying to be everything instead of being one thing really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh well. Hashtag next story. Expect many more books from the Love You Forever author. Robert Munsch has arranged for around 50 unpublished children's books to be released posthumously. Best known for classics like Love You Forever and The Paper Bag Princess, Munsch made these plans following diagnosis of Parkinson's disease and dementia. The news elicits questions about how authors manage their literary legacies, including the rules they set for unfinished or unpublished work. By contrast, Terry Pratchett famously ordered his unfinished manuscripts destroyed by steamroller, an instruction that was carried out by a vintage vehicle by the name of Lord Jericho.
That's incredible.
Yeah, they denied him that though. They didn't really destroy his manuscripts. So,
What?
yeah, which I think is justifiable. I think that guy was a lunatic, by the way. There was something really wrong with him,
I don't
but
know. That's his wish. But I think it brings up the question for authors, like, when do you start thinking about this, about what's going to be done with your work after you die, or do you?
I can tell you, I started thinking about it when I started skiing. Going down that hill, I thought about it quite a bit.
JD flying down a hill trying to pizza his way to a stop. Like, Jesus Lord, don't let me
Yeah, I'm like,
die.
I owe my lawyer a call about a trust, about a will. I need to do something about future books. need to not hit that kid in front of me. You know, very few of us, I think, actually come up with plans for this. And it's really silly. You know, like I think like I've got books, you know, on my computer right now that, you know, they're in my publication queue. But I'm kind of the only one who knows that. My assistant kind of knows where to find it. But like stuff like that, I think is really important. And I think we need to decide, like, if, you know, especially if you're prolific, if you're writing more books than you can actually put out, like, you know, if you're a traditional author and only letting you put out one or two a year and you're writing four or five, yeah. You know, you need to find a way to stockpile those and find a way to release them, or at least get them in the hands of your heirs if you want to go that route. You know, and for the bigger selling authors, like if you don't do it, your publisher is going to take control of this too. I mean, depending on your contract, they could Tom Clancy you and start bringing in co-authors and keep things going. There's a million different directions this could go if you don't, you know, take the reins yourself and come up with a plan. I think somebody else is going to.
I have not traditionally had this problem because every time I finish writing something, I'd go ahead and get it ready and publish it. But in the past 2 years, suddenly I have a body of unpublished work to think about. And so I had written some instructions to Kara when I was going in for to have my pacemaker battery replaced, just in case I didn't make it off the table. I should just take that, expand it, and make it an actual, like, you know, last will and testament or something. But I think what I'm going to do is after my death, my wishes are for all my manuscripts to become mega bestsellers. So that's please honor my wishes. Perfect. And also my death is retroactive to my birth.
Excellent. Okay, we'll get that up.
You know that manuscript you've been editing for the past year? One that's almost done but never quite gets there? Well, right now it's crying out for help from this episode's sponsor, AutoCrit. Quite possibly the most powerful all-in-one writing platform, AutoCrit puts an entire publishing team in the palm of your hand. Get access to customizable automated alpha and beta readers, plus series-wide story analysis, marketing support, line editing tools that can help you catch the mistakes you miss, and even more, including exclusive craft events only for members. The value is insane, and right now you can grab lifetime access for just one payment. No monthly fees, no usage limits, no caps, no tokens. At AutoCrit, unlimited means unlimited. It's time to finish your book, start making real progress, escape revision limbo, and publish with confidence story after story. Check out autocrit.com/JD to save 50% on lifetime membership right now. That's autocrit.com/JD.
All right, JD, who is up this week?
This week, we've got Amy Sudo coming on. Amy began her career as a Hollywood TV writer before hitting the road and becoming a digital nomad as a six-figure freelance writer. Now she travels the world while ghostwriting memoirs and working on her own creative projects. Her latest novel is called Write for Money and Power, The Anti-Starving Artist's Guide to Becoming a Seven-Figure Writer, and it releases January 12th. Here she is, Amy Sudo.
Hi, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, I'm actually really, really excited to talk to you. Mindset is like one of the things I am obsessed with. And I know that sounds like really weird, but it's true.
Yeah, I think it's just so important. I think for creatives in the modern world, with like all of the information that is just hitting us from social media, from different institutions and gatekeepers, like we're all told to be a certain way or do certain things or follow certain ladders. And so I do think mindset is kind of like the basis of having a good creative career.
Yeah, I agree. I just feel like it also goes with writing so like well too, right? Because like writing is like almost like, you know, to think, right? We're thinking about things and we're sort of pondering like the great what ifs. Like it feels like writing is sort of like modern philosophy in a way, even if you're writing like, you know, a serial killer thriller. So I don't know. I feel like it just like, it's one of those things that I feel gets under, it just doesn't get paid attention to or talked about. So yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you.
Thank you. Thanks. I'm really excited to talk with you too.
Yeah, so before we kind of get into some of these, like higher level philosophy thinking, let's start at the beginning. What is your writer origin story? How did you get started writing?
Yeah, so I knew I always wanted to be a writer. I went to USC for film school. I basically
Oh,
entered the film industry when the TV bubble had yet to burst. So everybody was like, you just got to climb the ladder. You've got to be an assistant. You've got to make it to getting your first episode. And then it'll just magically unfold from there. And so I
yep.
listened to everybody. I did that. I got my first episode of TV. And then the ladder just dropped off. And I was like, okay, all
As it
right.
does.
So, and then from there, even though I worked for some great people, I had some great experiences in Hollywood. When 2020 hit and everything shut down, I had a chance to reevaluate everything. And in between writers' rooms for, the past chunk of time when I was in Hollywood, I was moonlighting as a memoir ghostwriter. And what started to happen is that my memoir ghostwriting clients in my freelancing business were so excited to fly me out to write their book, and they were paying me way more than I was getting paid in Hollywood. And they were being so like complimentary of my writing skills. And I was like, okay, I think that there's something missing that I'm getting all of these green lights in my freelancing business that I'm not getting from Hollywood in this career. So I ended up switching gears, traveling the world, leaving LA, and for the last almost 6 years, like the last five and a half years, I've been traveling the world. I recently settled down in San Francisco with my partner Kyle, and I'm a full-time freelance writer. I write my own books. I'm a best-selling author, and I also run a best-selling Substack called Make Writing Your Job. So this is my like this is what I do every day, and I absolutely love it.
That's incredible. I love stories like that where like some of the things that have happened to me are like the pivots that you don't expect. And yet somehow I feel like, you touched on it like at the beginning and even in your book a little bit, like people sort of, present to you like there is a path. Right. There's one true path that you follow if you want to be successful. Thanks, Dad. And I find that like so often it's not true. It's those unexpected pivots. And if you learn how to listen to that, I guess great things happen. So I guess out of curiosity, what do you think if you had to kind of go back and think about it, made you listen?
Yeah, so I wrote my book Rape for Money and Power for my younger self because I think that at so many places I was like, I have been told by these people that I admire that I need to follow this path, even though my heart's kind of pulling me in another direction. I've always loved writing novels. When I was a kid, I did National Novel Writing Month, but I didn't write a novel until way after 2020 to be published because I was just so caught up in this ladder that everyone told that I should climb if I wanted to have a great career in writing. And I think that the thing that most people don't realize is that in order to have a great career in writing, you have to create it for yourself. You can't rely on gatekeepers. I was in so many meetings with people who were promising me the sun and the moon that they would publish my or that they would produce my script, that they would do this and this, but I just had to do one thing. And that one thing was like another free task or something else. And so I ended up doing all this free labor in Hollywood and kind of being this like unpaid ghostwriter. And then on the flip side of my freelance work, my clients were paying me hundreds of dollars an hour at the time when I was still in Hollywood to ghostwrite their stories and to help them with their stuff. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. Like, I think that I need to understand where my value comes from as a creative and to understand that when you are being leveraged by a gatekeeper, like they are trying to take a cut of your creativity. Whereas when you go directly to your readers, to your clients, then you don't have a gatekeeper or a middleman who's kind of taking a slice out of what you're earning.
Yeah, I love that a lot. Like, know your value, which I feel is like a life lesson for everything, right? Because even if you're talking about, we talk about writing and writers, but like that's any business, right? Because I feel like that's kind of like the big conversation, like on LinkedIn, what you see a lot of people discussing is that exact thing, right? Like, if you're a high performer, it's because you're probably doing a little bit more, right? But the second you start to put boundaries up, what happens? Like, your boss gets real cranky at you, right? But they don't think twice about like Fred, who's over there, like doing 30% of the work because he's always done 30% of the work. So, yeah, that's, and I think that we fall for that. Particularly in creative industries, even more so. Like we're told, right? Even querying, you're writing for free until you're not.
Yeah, and I think that there's so much to be had and to be mined from self-publishing, and that's why my book, Write for Money and Power, talks about the benefits of having a paid newsletter, self-publishing, and having freelancing. Because those three pillars are really the thing that can make you indestructible as a writer. Because with paid newsletters, especially newsletters hosted on places like Substack, you're able to write for your audience directly, and they're able to pay you directly rather than you being hired by a magazine and then them paying the magazine and then all the staffers at the magazine. They're just paying you. And I think that this direct to consumer model makes things not only more affordable for the consumer, but it also allows the creatives to be paid more and removes the bureaucracy. And so I think when the math, I spent a lot of time in the book talking about both mindset and then math, because I think us creatives are not incentivized by these gatekeepers to actually do the math and realize when you're in Hollywood, well, you have to have an agent, you have to have a manager, they all take a cut. Even lawyers work on a percentage basis. And so suddenly, and that's pre-tax revenue. Like that's like off of your gross. So I think that there is so much stuff going on that we don't even realize as creatives that are being taken from us when we just opt into the road that everybody tells us to go. And so my book is really trying to shake loose that fact. And it's also a trend that is unfolding on Substack and other places of big published writers who are moving to self-publishing. Some of the examples I give in the book are obviously like Taylor Swift repurchasing her masters and self-publishing her tour book. Brandon Sanderson, one of the biggest fantasy authors of all time, who you'd think would be just completely adored by his publishing company, ended up going and self-publishing a Kickstarter campaign for several books and making hundreds of millions of dollars and setting a record. And so I think that when we think that when we look at these huge creative people that are changing the game, they're all leaning towards ownership. They're eliminating gatekeepers and they're going directly to their readers, directly to their fans. And so that's a trend that's unfolding. And I think that sometimes it can be scary to do that because it means that we have to add some skill sets as creatives and lean a little bit more into the business side of things. But if we just add a few extra skill sets, then it completely unlocks our time and our space as a creative to be more creative and have more energy to make the stuff we actually want to make.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think, one of the things that I think feels very daunting, and I know you talk about it in your book, you talk about, like creating a brand and you create, like habits and rituals and things like that. But what you had just said, creating those three pillars, I think that can even feel daunting, like for a brand new writer, right? Like maybe you haven't, quite finished your first novel, even to self-publish. And, so what do you talk about on your newsletter? What do you, how, what do I do? Where do you go for the freelancing? Like kind of those things. I wonder if you could talk a little bit sort of about like, how they might tackle these kinds of questions.
Yeah, definitely. And in the book, I have a 12-month plan. If you want to have all three pillars come out at once and tackle them all, I have a step-by-step roadmap. But I think that it really just comes to just picking one and starting there. And the nice thing about all three pillars is that they all feed into each other. So the posts that you put out on Substack can then become portfolio pieces for your freelancing clients. The posts you put out on Substack can also feed a book that you're writing. Sometimes there's been some really high-end Substacks who've started as serialized fiction and then some morphed into other things, some stuck with the fiction. There's some really great long-form essayists on the platform too. So what you put out in your newsletter feeds these two other things. So you're almost getting two other additional pieces of benefit to your writing career for the price of one. And so there's some really easy ways that you can kind of wade into these waters. And that's the tips and kind of the ways that I break it down in my book to try to make it okay. In the first part of the book, we're going to talk about mindset. We're going to talk about all the things you have to understand about why this approach really works for writers, why you should really kind of put yourself into the identity of your future self and bring those habits to the future, from the future to the present. And then within the three pillars, here's how you get started with each and just taking things step by step. I even have one of the exercises is like 15 minutes to start your Substack, like all you need, 15 minutes. And so I try to really break things down and have the tips be actionable. I actually had 90 beta readers read the book to help me make sure I was pressure testing every single chapter, every single section, because I really wanted to make sure that whatever my readers got out of this, they would get very, not only a pep talk, but also very actionable advice to grow their business from nothing if they're a brand new writer and trying to figure all this stuff out.
Yeah, that's really incredible. I do think that the book it's written very, it's organized and like laid out very well.
Thank you.
Very easy to like flip through if you have a specific question or if you just want to read, straight through page one to, I forget how many pages in there, a couple hundred, but Shifting just a little bit, I'd love to talk about sort of your writing process a little bit too, because you are a writer. You tackle, fiction, nonfiction, freelance work. Like you kind of run the gambit of you did screenwriting. Like if there's maybe you did poetry, I don't know. But what does your writing process look like, and does it change depending on what project you're working on?
Yeah, I think that I've always had a very unfussy writing process. Some people have like rituals and routines. I think that's great. I think that whatever works for you is awesome. But because I came up doing National Novel Writing Month in high school through college, I did it every single year, just wrote 50,000 words in November. I've kind of like trained myself to just be in this mentality of like, I'm just going to sit down on my computer and write the thing. And I think that the way that you can get to that, you don't have to do NaNoWriMo every November to get there, but I think it's trying to understand mindset. Because when I was doing National Novel Writing Month, the thing that I really learned from it was how to take your editor, your inner editor that was giving you, telling you that your work isn't good or readers won't like it, and just tell them to be quiet for a moment and let you cook. And I think
Yeah.
that if you're able to just be like, I'm just going to sit down and write 1,000 words today. They don't have to be good. I could just type one word over and over if I have to get to those 1,000 words, but just allowing yourself to write anything at any quality level to get to a certain word count is really helpful, especially for book writing or book ghostwriting. And then you can go back and refine it later. So I think that if somebody is having trouble just kind of like getting into the flow of writing, starting a word count goal, or just saying, I'm going to publish one, newsletter post every week for my newsletter, or I'm going to post, one time on my per week on my blog, if you have a blog, or I'm going to do one chapter per week or this many words, then it kind of ties your success metrics to output rather than, perceived value. And I think that that will release you as a writer. And then from there, you can kind of adjust based on audience feedback, reader feedback, things like that. But I think then it's about trying to figure out how to protect your artist self in a little bubble, and then putting on your editor or even marketer cap later down the line, and really kind of protecting those pieces of the process.
Yeah, I like that. The process always. Do you tend to like plot your work, or do you just really embrace that NaNoWriMo? I'm just gonna sit down when I'm here and just see what happens.
Yeah, no, I think outlining has become very important, especially as a freelancer. But when I was coming up in Hollywood as a TV writer, what I realized is that, outlining is how the sausage gets made. When you're in a room full of writers and you're given an episode, you have to be on the same page because somebody is writing the episode right after you or right before you. So your outline is king and you have to stick to it. And I think that I take that kind of like militant outlining style into my ghostwriting work. So when I'm doing ghostwriting with a memoir ghostwriting client, I have two outlines that I deliver for them. I deliver a macro outline that is like, here are the themes of your life story. Here's how it's going to be presented. How it's going to flow. And your arc is going to unfold. And then I'll deliver them a chapter outline, which is more kind of mechanical, being like, here's chapter one, and like a little excerpt of like a line of dialogue from chapter one or an exchange. And here's chapter 20, and here's how the reader's going to feel reading this, and this. And so I go very hard on the outline so that my client knows what their book is going to become before we get there. And I think that that's really important if you're a freelancer, to set up those expectations. And then that experience has bled into my own work as a fiction author. And when I'm writing romanticy or my detective series, then I'm also very detailed on the planning because I do think that helps, but I still leave room for spontaneity too.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. I do notice that if you spend any time in screenwriting, yes, like that outline, I've come to embrace the outline wholeheartedly. It's very, very important now. I think process and mindset really kind of go hand in hand. You As you said, you open the book, like we go straight into mindset. What is it? How do you talk about it? I really love, the idea of, these limiting beliefs and how we impose them on ourselves. And you had very strong motivation, I won't get into spoilers, to find sort of that drive to shift your mindset. But, sometimes, oftentimes, we don't kind of get hit with those like do or die moments. So, what do you think? How do you think people can go about changing their mindset? And then, what do you think the obstacles come up that they should be aware of?
Yeah, I think that most mindset shifts need to happen because fear is holding back people as a writer. And if you're having trouble with writer's block, that's fear. If you're having trouble with committing to one project, that's fear. If you have trouble with putting yourself out there, hitting publish on a piece of work or sharing it with a writer's group, that's fear. And so a lot of the mindset work that's helped me and that I've seen has helped with a lot of the writers that I've worked with or helped or just, noticed in my career is getting over that fear. And that's why I am such an advocate of having a paid newsletter as part of your stack as a writer, because it forces you every week to hit publish. And I think that muscle is really important because then you're putting your work out there and also getting feedback. And there's some really, really incredible people and communities out there that will support you as a writer when you start getting into that muscle of consistency of hitting publish. And so the mindset work that I put in Write for Money and Power and really fill into that first half of the book or first third of the book is thinking about, how do you address haters? Because at a certain point, like all of us are going to get somebody who leaves a one-star review on our book on Amazon. Like that's a badge of honor. That's not something to be afraid of. And so I think that that's something that like, I walk through these exercises when I'm working with my developmental editor clients and preparing them for publication as part of my package that I offer with them. And I have worked with a lot of authors who like are staring down publishing, being like I'm afraid of to see what's on the other side of that. But what's on the other side of that is the satisfaction of knowing that you put a book out there in the world, that you have shared something that's is going to move somebody. And even though some people might hate you for it, like they're not the people that you actually want to, impress. Like there was a good quote by Alex Hormozi the other day where he was saying that basically if you knew everybody in the world personally, you wouldn't want to be liked by everybody in the world. Like you really don't. And I thought that that was so great. And I think that as an entrepreneur, he gives a lot of good advice around kind of tuning out the noise. And I think that for writers, we don't hear those kinds of messages enough because like so many people are trying to tell writers, well, you got to have thick skin. If you're in Hollywood, you got to take all the advice. But I also think that some of that has kind of contributed to some of Hollywood's downfall of the TV bubble bursting and the content not performing as well, is because in order to be really experimental and new and fresh as a voice, you have to take some big swings and you have to just be like, I'm going to not listen to the critics. I'm going to put out something pretty crazy. And sometimes the only way that you can do that is if you are self-publishing or if you have your own platform.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually really insightful. I think like what you said, especially with like because you do you hear and I think it's like very important, but it's one of those two sides of the same coin, right? Like as a writer, like you do have to be like open to feedback, and you do have to be open to like if you're working with an editor and they're telling you can't be precious with like your words or your characters, right? Like you have to always like do what's best for the story, not like your idea for the story. But like you said, it is interesting to think about how that can be abused, because now you have people who might come in and tell you that this is the worst thing they've ever read, or and you have to change it. And in your gut, you know that that's not what's best for the story, but you're told to take it. So that's actually really interesting to think about.
Yeah, and that's why the self-published model is so great, because you only need to find somewhere between 1,000 to 10,000 true fans. And this was a great personal essay that was published. I think the author's name is Kevin Kelly. I have to look it up. But this idea of just finding your true fans, and if you find those true fans and they each pay you $10 a year at 10,000 fans, that's $100,000 a year, and that's more than enough to live out off as a creative. And if in the internet age, there's so many amazing, different niches that you can have as a writer where you're going to find your 10,000 fans if you are able to put out your work far enough and kind of have enough reach. And so it's truly with a self-publishing model, like you don't need millions of readers each year. You may only need 10,000. And with the kinds of tools that we have available for us today, a lot of different, paid newsletter tools like Substack have organic reach that push you out to new readers without you having to do anything. And I think that these pieces can help supercharge your career and get to those 10,000 fans of people who will support your work no matter what, year after year. And that's what we should be moving towards, not trying to hand over the keys of the kingdom to a gatekeeper who will then kind of take our audiences and hold them away from us and hold us hostage to them as the gatekeepers. And so if we are able to own the email list of our fans and be able to reach them with our work, then we're powerful as writers and creatives. And that's something that you cannot get through traditional means.
Yeah, that's a it's a very very interesting way of looking at the whole business. And I really love how you reframe like immediately the idea of money and power as freedom. Because I do think like sometimes I think, well, I'm not in it for the money. I'm in it for the art, or I don't want to be powerful. Like I don't need to influence people. And it's like, but they both do equal freedom to a certain extent. And part of that is shifting from that creator to a CEO. What are some small things like a writer could do right now that would help them shift towards that would shift towards achieving that CEO mindset?
Yeah, I honestly think it's very simple. I think hitting publish on a paid newsletter and starting to collect the email addresses of people who want to support you, that's something that can be done in 15 minutes that you can immediately start kind of bringing people into your world and telling them what you're writing about and giving them a behind the scenes look of your process and sharing with them what you're working on for an upcoming project. I know some writers who even serialize fiction where they just practice in public. Like there's some, very notable writers like Andy Weir with The Martian who put each chapter out like as a serialized novel and then edit it and put it together. So there's so many different ways that you can just get started, and everything kind of depends on what niche you're in, what type of writer you're in. But honestly, just the easiest thing is to put out a paid newsletter, collect email addresses, because in the world where social media algorithms can sometimes hide your content from your followers and prioritize other creators, you don't own that audience. You don't own an audience that is kept behind gatekeepers. And so I do think that that's so simple and a great way you can start moving beyond that. And then even just with in terms of writers wanting to grow an income when they're still growing their follower base, freelance writing is a great way to step into that kind of CEO mindset because you're able to understand that your skills are valuable as a writer and sell your storytelling ability to clients who want to work with you. And you can sell that at a premium and replace your corporate salary. Like I know a lot of writers on our job board over at Make Writing Your Job have done that this year, and it's so cool to see. And so I think that a lot of people don't recognize how valuable writers are or how valuable their talent is because we've been told to not want money as writers, to not want money and power and influence, but we all have bills to pay. And we also have an incredibly valuable skill set that people are willing to pay for. And that's also part of the reason why I started the writing job board at Make Writing Your Job and started funneling clients to it and helping writers bridge that gap of being just a writer to being a working writer. Because so many of these elite institutions are not actually going to give you what you're worth, but these freelancing clients will. And so it's about kind of shifting your mindset and having the tools that will help you get there.
Yeah, that is really cool. I do have to ask, because we do have a lot of independent writers, but we have a lot who, are would like to go the traditional route and whether that leads to a hybrid or not. But is there ever like a way that you can make traditional publishing work in your three pillar structure?
I think that, I mean, if you want to go traditionally published, then most publishers will tell you that they won't publish you until you have 10,000 subscribers on Substack. And I've heard that from multiple people who have agents. And so if you want to go the traditional publishing route, you're going to still need a following anyways. And so that's why I think that on your way to traditional publishing, you can still freelance. We have a lot of freelancers on our job board who are editors and who do developmental editing on the side of their project. So it's kind of a different skill set. And I think that there's a lot of different ways that you can have this all come together. And if you want to continue being traditionally published or go down that route, then freelancing is a great kind of stopgap in between the different paychecks that you get from publishers, which are very drawn out. And so
They
we do
are.
have a lot of traditionally published authors as part of our community. And I think that it's something that if people want to go that route, that's awesome. And sometimes it really works for people. But I do see that a lot of traditionally published authors are actually shifting to self-publishing, even if they've been traditionally published for years. And so it would be a disservice for me to not try to get people to go that route, especially as a memoir ghostwriter, seeing my own high-profile clients switching to self-publishing. But yes, you can obviously like opt into that route and then still have these other pillars work around it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it's kind of interesting to think about how those different things and being able to use your skill set in a variety of ways. I think it's good for writers to think about that. We kind of tend to, I think, get a little like I'm a fiction writer, but you have a lot more skills. Writing is a difficult thing, as you mentioned, and so you have a lot more than just being able to, argue with made up people in your brain.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of fiction writers don't realize that developmental editing is actually a really good pair as a freelancing job, because developmental editing, unlike line editing, is not about catching typos. It's about giving somebody high-level story notes about what characters are working and what is like really kind of like ending up, being successful for a finished book versus what's holding the writer back. And so you get to operate on this high level of story you already have. And because self-publishing is becoming such a bigger industry, we are having more self-published authors in need of great developmental editors. And so this is kind of the interesting gap that is currently existing of people needing to hire great developmental editors, but not enough people have made that leap to freelance to be able to satisfy that need. And we've had one of our writers build a complete freelance business from scratch in like 4 months this year with developmental editing. And so I think that that is something that a lot of people are overlooking, because when you first think about editing, you're like, oh, that's too hard. I don't want to work on other people's stuff. But it actually makes you a better writer to work as an editor. And it also has this other version of cash flow. And it's a slightly different brain, part of your brain than when you're writing and generating from scratch. So I think that that's really accessible for writers who want to get into freelance writing. And then also ghostwriting, it suits very well with fiction writers, because you're basically stepping into the voice of your client rather than a voice of another character. And so that's why a lot of clients like hiring fiction writers, because you already have that experience.
Yeah, that's I love hearing all of that. I really I think editing actually does make you a much better writer, and not just editing your own stuff, but other people's stuff. It like sharpens that part of your brain that like doesn't get used in the same way when you're doing your own stuff. So yeah, that's I think people are really gonna find a lot. Your book was, really helpful, and I love being able to look at problems from different angles, kind of, see things in a new light. I think that that's like really exciting, and it actually gets me like really creative and energized. So, I
Yeah,
mean, I
thank you.
yeah. And I could talk to you for hours. I'm having a great time, but we do need to wrap up. And we like to end the show with, what's one piece of advice you would give new or aspiring writers?
Yeah, I think don't be afraid of hitting publish. Even on something that isn't perfect, I think perfectionism will keep all of your best stories in a drawer. I think you'd be surprised how even something that you don't think is perfect is going to really be perfect for somebody else. And a lot of people just let their work wither, and it's meant to be read. Everything that you write is meant to be read. Yes, you'll need to edit it and shape it up and things like that, but I think that you can't let the cycle of perfectionism keep you from hitting publish on your work, even if it's not 100% exactly where you want it to be. The good things happen on the other side of putting yourself out there.
I absolutely love that. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So she was really fun to talk to. Really interesting how her career advanced. And I think mindset, I don't know, people use that word a lot, but then I also kind of feel like it's very underrated and like misunderstood in a way. So it kind of made me wonder, what do you think the most important element of like a mindset is when it comes to like creating and writing for you personally?
I mean, I've always done that. Like back when I worked in the brokerage industry, and it's like if you ever seen Wolf of Wall Street, I literally worked in the middle of that back in the 90s. But one of the things they drilled into our head when we were first starting off, I think we got paid $150 a week. But we bought extremely expensive suits, we rented very expensive cars, and we basically started living that lifestyle until the income caught up with it. So we basically convinced ourselves we were successful before we were successful. So I've kind of done that my entire life. I've kind of created, okay, this is what I want to become, this is what I want to be, and then like I put that up on a pedestal somewhere, and then I start chasing it, and it always seems to work out. And it's funny because like if you take a step back, my wife is creating a brand new business right now, and the website is finally done, and like just having the website out there, something that defines what it is, the name of the company, the logo, what you're doing, who you're doing it for, all those things, it creates a mindset and it gives you a goal to obtain. So I think it's very important to do this.
I've always been this. I think we've talked about this again, but my mindset is always optimistic tenacity. That's, if you're going into it, that's what it's got to be, I think.
I've always operated under that policy of I'm already a success. Like I, and it is kind of a little bit of the fake it till you make it thing, but it's like do everything that you're going to do it as if you've succeeded at it, which includes things like early on in my career, I made sure my books were, edited, had good covers, at least to the best of my capabilities. There were flaws for sure, but everything looked. I remember a friend of mine picking up my first book, and he'd always been skeptical about self-publishing. And he looks and flips through and he says, "Well, this looks like a real book." And I'm like, "Go figure."
Yeah, I do think it is like that. You kind of have to make a choice, like to be successful or not to be successful, which sounds like woo-woo, but I definitely think that there is something to it. I also really liked what she said that once you sort of start developing these mindsets, then you can start seeing green flags and being able to identify where to find those, which I think it's interesting in terms of writing, particularly if you're querying, right? Because you're getting a lot of red flags, like, no, thank you, rejections. So how do you guys think you can see those green flags, like sort of train yourself to see the green flags, even if you're like sitting in a miasma of rejection?
I think that comes from experience too, right? Like I've always been very good at, somebody throws something negative in front of me, I find some way to spin that and turn it into a positive. I don't just take it and move on. Like I find some way to twist it around. I think just being able to do that, I think, is helpful. And then when the green flags actually do show up, they're kind of the layups. They're the easy ones.
Yeah. Speaking of querying, which is the worst and I hate it, one of the things that for me was helpful was looking at like an agent doing a breakdown of what they got in a year, and she put it up on her website. She's got something like maybe more than 10,000
Yeah, right, yeah.
queries in a year, and asked for a full on like 0.01% of those, and then signed zero authors. So
Right.
that for me was like, if you're getting those rejections, you have to know that doesn't mean your work is not good. You have beta readers. They're like, I love this. I'd pay money for that. That's a green flag. So I think, like she said, sometimes you have to make your career yourself. So if you know that it's really good and you've really got something, you might have to look
Yeah.
for another way to get it out there, right?
You should take every rejection letter you get and run it through AI and say, "Tell me what the positives are in this rejection letter."
Yeah.
And it'll
Oh, that's
filter out everything.
interesting.
I just thought of that. Haven't done it yet. Don't know what the result will be.
Mostly I hear use AI for this, and it's like, well, I don't know, but that's actually quite interesting.
Because what we do is tend to we zero in on the negative, right? So, we're wired that way, and we don't tend to if even if like I know my wife is pretty good at this, but like if she gets some sort of rejection or some sort of rebuff, all she hears is the negative part of
Yeah.
it. And there's almost always some nugget of something useful, if not positive, in a rejection letter. So we filter it out because we're so hurt. But having a truly, genuinely objective third party look at it and find that stuff for you and just report that to you is,
Yeah.
I think, would be a really handy thing to do. I haven't
Yeah.
tried it yet. I'm not advocating it
Yeah.
as someone who's done it,
Yeah. We're
but it
wired
seems like a
to
good
see
idea.
negative, which is awful. I do some of
We
this
are.
at work in my day job. And we talk about it with kids. You've had a fantastic day. Maybe you won your sports game, whatever. You got an A on your test, but you're on the bus and some kid calls you a loser. And you're in that space for 8 hours, right? Where everything else has gone well. So I don't know. Yeah, it's sometimes hard to get out of that negative space when one bad thing happens and we take it so personally. So I like that idea, Kevin. That's actually a great idea.
I would probably take it a step further and then ask the AI to give you a summary of things that you can actually change. Like based on all these letters that I got, what improvements do I need to make? And it might see through a lot of the BS and see through what's actually written there and give you an itemized list.
You could also just say, "AI, rewrite this letter so that it loved my submission," and then post that up on your wall. There's where the woo comes in.
Do you remember? I know Christine did. We used to do this, the blackout poetry with rejection letters. Did you guys ever see that trend on Twitter a
That's
couple years
hilarious.
ago?
No.
Maybe.
Oh, it was great. You'd post a rejection letter, but you'd black out everything negative, and you'd just be like, this is the best book ever. It was
nice. Cathartic for sure.
Those make great cover blurbs too, you know. Like, I've never with read a book blackout. That made me question my humanity.
Yeah. So she talked a lot about like the essential skills that writers need and how particularly as things do evolve to sort of require you to take a more hands-on approach to your career as a writer. You know, it's no longer, you know, you get an agent, get a publisher, and then all you do is write. And I know we've talked about this before, but in terms of like how she had put those three pillars, like what would your three pillars be that are made of like of those essential skills if you had to sort of like summarize that?
I need coffee for this exercise.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about it because she's like, oh, we just need some business skills that are essential. And I'm like, well, which ones? Will you tell us more?
That's why you got to read the book.
Gotta read the book, man.
You do have to read the book. She does
the newsletter for sure is good.
Or have AI summarize the book.
Yeah, I like the newsletter idea. I should do better with that.
Now you were asking like what the tenets would be, like three tent poles, right? Like
yeah.
So the newsletter folds into the actual overall tent pole of building your own audience, building your own platform. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing I would tell anybody to do right from the start. It's kind of funny because years ago, I was having conversations with authors all the time about when they should start their newsletter, when they should start a mailing list. I'm like, before you even have a book is the right time to do it. Yeah. And I know that that sounds hard, but you get all the really hard stuff out of the way while you're still kind of, you know, you can actually enlist that audience to help you with shaping the book if you want. So that's number one. I think, you do need to have some business sense, but here's the big dirty secret. You don't have to have any business sense. There's people for that. You can actually go out and hire people to help you do the bits that you don't understand. If you don't want to have to take on marketing, I mean, that means money, you know, it means an expense on your part. And there are certain basic things you can learn and do on your own. Believe me, you can. But you don't have to worry about how am I going to market this book once it's written? You know, there's little things you can do to market it yourself. And then you work on getting someone else to help you market it if you can't do it. I mean, that's just the rules of business. You don't have to do every single thing yourself.
There's an app for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Great. JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Becca Brinkmeyer coming on. She's a USA Today bestselling author and ghostwriter of more than 90 novels. She works with AutoCrit as an instructor and author coach, leading Team Plantzer in the Novel 90 Writing Challenge. She loves helping writers untangle their ideas, build confidence, and turn rough drafts into finished books. Becca Brinkmeyer.
All right, sounds fun. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Pizza.
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 Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.